Good morning. I'm Caroline Young, president of the Nashville Healthcare Council, and I would like to welcome you here this morning. Thank you for taking the time to be with us on such an exciting day for Nashville. I'd like to begin the program by recognizing our sponsors. They are Aon, Bolt Cummings, Connors & Berry, the Federation of American Hospitals, and Integrated Medical Systems. Thank you for your help in making this day a reality. Now with that, I'm going to hand the podium over to Tom Sigran, who is Chairman of Healthways and Chairman of the Nashville Healthcare Council.
Well, good morning, and thank you all for being here at this sold-out event. This distinguished group of speakers certainly deserves no less from Nashville. Before we get started, I'd like to introduce a couple of special friends who are with us this morning. First, Congressman Jim Cooper. Jim. And former Governor of Tennessee, Ned Ray McWhirter. Governor. Well, in the midst of a lot of rhetoric about health care and health care reform, more of which I'm sure we'll hear tonight at the debate, we thought it would be really worthwhile and interesting to hear from this distinguished group of experts who are here on the podium about what is the art of the possible, what is likely really to happen as a result of all these campaign promises that we're hearing. And so to moderate this panel, and we have about an hour and a half, just short of an hour and a half to talk about these things, is Senator Bill Frist. As all of us Tennesseans know, he's represented Tennessee in the state in the U.S. Senate from 1995 to 2007, was the majority leader from 2002 until 2007. He is currently a partner and chairman of the executive board at Cressy & Company, a private equity firm, and he's the Frederick H. Schultz Visiting Professor of International Economic Policy, that's a lot to get on a business card, at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Consistently recognized among the most influential leaders in American healthcare, founding director of the Vanderbilt Multi-Organ Transplant Center, having performed more than 150 heart and lung transplants, authored 5 books, written more than 100 peer-reviewed articles, an overachiever.
Still struggling.
So with that, Senator Frist, thank you for agreeing to moderate this panel, and we look forward to your remarks.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Tom, thank you, and welcome to everybody. It's an exciting day for Nashville, Tennessee, and I can't think of a better way to get things kicked off than for me to have the opportunity to welcome this distinguished panel from, and thank goodness, it's my former town of Washington, D.C., but everybody up here is from Washington and very close friends and colleagues that we've worked all together in different shapes and forms over the last 14 years. No issue debated during this presidential election will rival the impact on the people in this room than the issue that we're going to be talking about today, health care reform. What's really possible? What's going to happen? Let's predict, prognosticate, look into a crystal ball, always ready to eat crushed glass. We're honored today to have literally some of the most highly respected experts and policy makers, thought leaders, prognosticators in the country. I'll briefly introduce them. I think all of you have their bios, extended bios, but just to give you a little bit of a feel, first we have Chris Jennings to my immediate left. Chris is the president of Jennings Policy Strategies, a healthcare policy and advocacy consulting firm in Washington, D.C. Prior to launching JPS, Chris was a senior healthcare advisor to President Bill Clinton, the congressional liaison for First Lady Hillary Clinton, and a senior advisor at the Healthcare Financing Administration. Next to Chris is a friend to many of us. Most of us here in the room know Chip Kahn very well, president of the Federation of American Hospitals. Chip's distinguished career includes serving as staff director for the House Ways and Means Health Subcommittee and acting as a health policy advisor to Senators David Durenberger and Dan Quayle. Also joining us is a familiar face to everybody in the room. If you were on watching TV at 6 o'clock this morning, he is there. He was there at 11 o'clock. I went to bed after an event last night with Governor McWhirter and Jim Cooper and so many of us last night. I went to bed watching him. So welcome and thank you for being with us, Dick Morris. Dick,
nice to wake you up in the morning.
That's right. Had a nightmare last night, but that's okay. A former Clinton administration advisor is now a Fox News commentator and a consultant to integrated medical strategies. Dick played an instrumental role, as everyone in this room knows, in 5 successful Arkansas gubernatorial campaigns by President Clinton, including that comeback victory in 1982. And in total, again, at dinner last night, as I was talking to by Don Sundquist there, everybody knows Dick Morris, who's been in politics. Dick has managed more than 30 winning campaigns for senators and governors, including my former colleague Trent Lott of Mississippi, Governors Bill Weld of Massachusetts, Pete Wilson of California, the list goes on.
And Don.
And Don Sundquist, that's right. We were sitting together last night, and he told me about a very early race between you two. Back, you've been at it a long time. John Podesta, we were just in Africa together, actually, about 2 months ago on a wonderful journey. We won't be talking about that today, but again, a close friend who is president and CEO of a think tank in Washington, a prominent think tank in Washington, the Center for American Progress. John has held a number of important, impressive positions throughout federal government, including former chief of staff to President Clinton, counselor to former United States Majority Leader Tom Daschle. So thank all of you for being here. Again, there are more extended bios in your program. We got a lot to cover. We're taking health care on, the issues of quality, the issues of cost, the huge gaps that are out there today. We all know the history, but it is interesting how close we sometimes get, but we are always stopped. We had Social Security created in the 1930s, but it was 3 decades before we saw what people were talking at the time, and that is real reform in our Medicare and Medicaid programs in the 1960s. Harry Truman talked a lot about a single-payer system, and you can't come to a group, although I bet you we don't talk too much about that today, but you really can't go to a health reform policy discussion group without talking about single-payer, yet we aren't near that. Should we be? Should we not? I don't know. The discussion just goes on and on. The last 3 presidents to tackle major comprehensive health care reform, President Nixon, Carter, and Clinton, all found themselves what we at least need to touch upon today, and which I saw again and again, and that is gridlock in Washington, D.C. 5 years have passed since the last major health care reform in Washington. A bill that, to be honest with you, as soon as I became majority leader, being a doctor, being from Nashville, my first act was to reach down and pull out the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003. And that was the last substantive discussion that we had in Washington that has resulted in legislation concerning health care. Our task today is to take health care and look at it through the eyes of the presidential campaigns. We'll talk a little bit about the plans, but I don't want the discussion to be, talking to my panel here, so much about the specifics of the plans, although we need to share what the fundamental points are, but really about the reality, the possibility, what will happen, what will impact everybody in this room today. I'm going to start, again, just to get the dialogue, so everybody up here, you'll get a feel a little bit about the past and a little bit about the perspective of each of our panelists, and then we'll jump right in with questions. And John, let me start with you, and you can talk a little bit about your own experiences, sort of where we are, and then let's just go straight down the line. John Podesta.
Thanks, Bill, and it's great to be in the football capital of the world. So
yeah.
Look, I think all of us could spend 20 minutes talking about what the healthcare problem is in the country with growing uninsured in our country, healthcare premiums rising 3 times faster than wages, people feeling the squeeze of low wage growth and high premium growth, small businesses being able to cover their employees, and large businesses, particularly those exposed to the global competition, really having a difficult time trying to manage their businesses in light of healthcare costs. We're not getting, if you think of public health outcomes, we're 31st in the world in life expectancy, 28th in infant mortality. So we're spending a lot. We're not getting enough for it. I think that as I reflect back on just the last 4 or 5 years, it seems to me there has been a sea change in the politics of this issue. In the last presidential campaign, the big idea was, could we expand children's health insurance coverage by 3 million? That was Senator Kerry's proposal. I think President Bush never made health care reform really a big priority in his presidency or in that campaign. This time around, I think, as a result of a lot of pressure from the business community, from think tanks like ours, from the work that everybody in this room does, I think health care is a more front and center issue. You might not know that from watching the campaign, particularly because of the financial crisis right now. But I think health care, the idea of expanded health care coverage was certainly a primary issue in the Democratic primaries. It's an issue that Senator McCain has very different ideas about, but he's come forward with a plan. And I would say that tonight, during the debate, I'm really glad that this is going to be a town hall meeting, because I think if we were stuck back into a moderated discussion with a mainstream reporter, a broadcast reporter, you'd probably never get to health care. And yet I will predict that when you ask average people to stand up and ask questions of the candidates, you're going to see at least one and maybe more than one question about what their plans are to deal with these real problems that plague the country. And as I said, they have very different approaches. I think we'll get into that in our discussion, as we should. But at least Senator Obama tried to bring that back with his advertising. We've gotten a little bit distracted on Charles Keating and some 1960s radical. But hopefully tonight, the debate here in Nashville with a town hall format will bring this back to a front and center concern.
Thank you, John. I think everybody knows, unlike the past ones, the questions are coming from the audience tonight. Well, I'm part of the audience, and they excluded 150 of us, but there are 150 people going to be on. All right, Dick, what about it?
Well, I hate to rain on the party, but the next president of the United States will have a job most analogous to a trustee in bankruptcy, and will have about as much flexibility as the average trustee in bankruptcy has, because the money for health care reform went out the door last week, and it's now happily percolating its way through the global economy. And when it's digested that and burped, there will then be other bailouts necessary, probably for the credit card squeeze, the auto loan squeeze, and then you'll have to double back to the good mortgages that are now bad because people lost their jobs. We're in for 3 or 4 years at least of a tremendous global recession, depression, and the President of the United States will be almost powerless to deal with any fundamental reform over the next 4 years because of the requisites of that situation. Now, the irony of this is that the political will be there. The Democrats will probably win the election for president. They will probably get 57 to 60 members of the Senate, enough so there is no practical filibuster possible. They'll gain 20 or 30 House seats. It'll be an absolute massacre as things stand now. I think McCain can come back a little bit, but I think that this election is moving in that direction. So you will have the political will for it, but you will not have the financial wherewithal for it. And I think that the push and pull between those will dominate the administration. And speaking as somebody who recently, as you know, has become more Republican than Democrat, the best outcome for the Republican Party is for the Democrats to take over for the next 4 years.
Thank you. We'll stick with this election, but 2012 we should ask you about. The $4.1 trillion will be spent over the next 10 years on Medicare, Medicaid, at least already obligated in law, $700 billion we just spent really $1 trillion in the last 2 weeks. So you start looking at the numbers, you see that we've already obligated $4.1 trillion. How much more is there? But we'll see. All right, I need some optimism. What about it? Chris?
That's my role. John wanted to go first so he could use that football line. I want that.
You know, it applies to even high school. It applies to the Titans and Vanderbilt and even down to high school. So we better stop talking football while we really will end up talking.
Well, I must say that at first blush, anyone who looks at this debate, you might conclude that meaningful health reform debate is off the table. And, you know, obviously you have to look at the economic situation, you look at the budget situation, you look at the polarization of the Congress, you look at the philosophical divides. You can go on and on and on and tell with all the reasons why health care reform can't get done. And frankly, in Washington, there are a lot of paid people who are self-fulfilling prophets of gridlock. But, you know, in Washington, sometimes, surprise, surprise, sometimes there people are wrong. And I'm going to give you six quick reasons as to why I think when it comes to health care, there is a very real viability that we could see some meaningful discussion of health care reform. First is, frequently we have major discussions of change in this country when we have crisis. And there's no greater crisis that is currently before us. Social Security came out of a Depression era, for goodness sake. So one really can't really predict where we're going into the future, but we know something that's called fundamental change is likely to occur. And actually, I think that there's a reason to believe that bigger in terms of healthcare reform may be easier than incremental, smaller. Washington is set up to kill small things. When you talk about bigger discussions, more policies are on the table, more levers to pull, and more interest in engagement. Secondly, the business community, both large and small, in bigger ways than I've ever seen before, are begging for us to really have a significant reform debate, largely because they don't think they can compete both domestically and internationally without the reform. Thirdly, and this is something John will remember, last time we had this debate going in, and let's just say Obama is coming in, we had a real debate between the economic team and the healthcare team as to whether we should engage in a real healthcare debate. The economic team are now first and foremost saying we have to have a healthcare debate to deal with our long-term economic needs. And when you have that sort of coalition of advisors advising the incoming president, I think that's very an optimistic scenario too. Fourthly, if you look at what's happening in Washington in the healthcare debate, it's all around this issue of quality and value. People believe that we are not getting what we should for our investment. And I think everyone in this room would agree with that. CBO Director Orzech goes around the country talking about a third of our expenditures are for care that do not improve outcomes or not secure better outcomes. What's a third of $2.1 trillion? $700 billion. Just what we just spent on this bailout. We can do a year what we spend on health care. And two more other points. One is that there's a greater understanding that the uninsured population contributes to the inefficiency of our health care system. If you have people going in and out, you can't do prevention, you can't do chronic care management well. If you have people in and out, you have insurers having to spend money underwriting to avoid those six populations. For all these reasons, there's a not just a moral calling, but an actual economic and policy calling to do this. And lastly, I'm going to stop with the people in this room. The people who know health care the most in this country, which I would suggest are people in this room, know that it's time for a change. And not only do they know that, they want to and they are engaging so much so that we're seeing hospitals, we're seeing physicians, we're seeing health plans, we're seeing drug companies, we're seeing business, labor, all begging to come together to have a real engagement in healthcare reform. And they all say that we understand that the second best option is no longer to do nothing. For all those reasons, I think there's a real possibility for a significant engagement in health reform.
Chip?
Well, thank you. I've got 5 points to make, which I'll go over in a minute, but I just want to respond. I'm a Republican, and you know, the trouble with not holding the high ground, and I don't disagree with your prognostication about the election, Dick, is that on the one hand you could say, well, the other guys will have all the trouble. On the other hand, you know, FDR was in there for a long time. The Republicans were out in the cold. And I did have the privilege of serving Republicans in the new Congress in 1995, but it was 40 years between 1953 and 1995. So you can stay out in the cold an awfully long time if you lose the election. I'd like to make 5 points this morning to sort of close out the first part of this session. First, from my view, new presidents only get so many wishes. They only get so many initial priorities that they can push. And it really depends as much, as Dick points out, on what's happening, on events, and on the American mindset at that time. And so at least right now, I don't think 2009 is ripe for an overhaul of American health care. In the current election, too, I do see discussion of health. But on the other hand, I view it as a defining issue right now, not a pivotal issue. I mean, it's one of those issues that the candidates are going to use in the next few days to pummel each other and define each other. But the election doesn't hinge on health care, not at least at this point. All that being the case, and short of major health care reform, I think Congress is primed for action next year. I've got three reasons why I say that. One, the child health insurance program needs to be reauthorized. It cycles out in March, and clearly Democrats in Congress want to do something about that. If Obama gets elected, it's part of his menu of proposals, and so that'll get done. Second, I think there's just this pent-up demand in a likely large majority Democratic Congress to act on health care. And finally, we face gargantuan deficits and this deteriorating economic crisis, which I think will lead to action on the budget and health care spending generally. So on the one hand, we can say Medicare is vulnerable to a big budget bill next year. On the other hand, that offers opportunity for legislation regarding Medicare that can be positive on self-referral, issues like that. So I see action next year, but I don't see an overhaul. All that being said, from my point of view, we really need universal coverage. And we need it, I think, from a policy standpoint, because we need something like that to propel the imagination of the public and policymakers. Without getting all Americans into the healthcare tent with at least a relatively level playing field, I don't think we can deal rationally with the issues of cost and quality. I think you've got to have everyone relatively equal to then do some of the hard things, because in some ways coverage, the cost is a problem, but coverage is the easy part. But on the other hand, everybody's got to feel like they're getting a part of the pie, I think, to then meet some of the hard issues on cost containment. And then I'll end on this note. I'm going to paraphrase Victor Fuchs, who's the Dean Emeritus of American Healthcare Economists. And Victor Fuchs, and I actually heard him say this, he said it many times, that the conditions for the enactment of national health insurance in this country will only occur if America is at war, suffering a major social unrest, or in depression. So I hope we don't have a depression. But at least from Victor Fuchs, we're sort of...
Meatloaf once said, two out of three ain't
we're sort of heading to the conditions that would lead to something. I'll end on that note.
Thank you. Well, so over here I'm hearing the fact, we'll come back to the economy. I don't want to jump right into it, but this may give us an opportunity that even 4 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago it may not foreseen if you're looking at comprehensive reform and not just incremental reform. Let me start... And I hope everybody in the room asks themselves this. And in classes, I always ask my students this before I first lecture in a course. Is if you sit back, what is your ethical bias, given our status in the world economy, although I'm not sure it's quite there now, do you view as an individual healthcare more of a consumer good or a social good? And people use it in debates, go back and forth, but I want each of you just to, again, we don't spend much time on it, but answer it for the candidates and then maybe yourself. And it in large part explains, because the world's kind of equally divided, or America is, or Tennessee is, in the answer to this. And the two camps are, and that's why I think there's a lot of gridlock there without leadership. Is it a consumer good, a private consumer good, whose financing is primarily, not entirely, the responsibility of its recipients, or is it a social good that should be available in roughly equal terms to all who need it and financed by members of society on the basis of their ability to pay? And let me start. I want all of you to say something, but I'll let any of you jump in. John, you want to start?
Well, I think the world has answered that question, that it's a social good. Only in the United States have we had this debate that roughly divides. I agree with you, Bill, that we roughly are divided between whether it's a consumer good or a social good. And I think to some extent the way our system's set up, it's a little bit of both. We need the application of sound economics on the consumer side to get the right kind of healthcare system. But ultimately, it's shameful that we have so many, particularly kids out of the system who aren't getting the kind of healthcare services that they need to succeed in life. And I think that as a society, if you think about it from the economic perspective of the nation as a whole, in order to have a workforce that's productive, that's kind of in the game, that's producing the kind of goods and services we expect, you need the social application of sound and solid health care. And from a moral side, I think it's, we have an obligation to each other to try to provide the sort of opportunity that this country has been built on to kind of help people succeed in life. They have to start with particularly, as I said, young people have to start healthy lives that are the general basis to let them succeed and expand opportunity. So I guess I think it's a little bit of both, but I lean towards the social.
Yeah,
well, it's easy to answer how the candidates see it. Neither a social good nor a consumer good, but a constituent service. and I think that's they clearly see it as something that they need to deliver to their constituency. But you come to the fundamental issue here. I work hard. I travel to Nashville and I give speeches and wake up in the middle of the night to do television so that I can make money. And I do that so that I can give my family security. And the most fundamental security I can give my family is guaranteed access to the top quality health care in the world. And I don't want to have to wait online based on need or based on availability or based on some bureaucrat's conception as to who needs what. I want my wife to come first. And I think that that's obviously the most fundamental of all capitalist motivations. So I think that whereas we would all agree that there is a social need, and we would all recoil at the idea, the almost Cro-Magnon idea, that people would be given health care based only on their wealth, and that therefore poor people would die faster and sooner and younger and lead worse lives. That's something we've left way behind. But on the other hand, when you deal with each individual person, there is not going to be a tolerance to waiting online simply because of the rationing of health care in the system. And my worry is that without real cost containment at the service delivery level, you are headed inevitably toward rationing. Not even so much because of the limitations on government money. That's part of it. But that's not the most important. There are only so many doctors to go around and so many nurses to go around. Now, you can always build new hospitals and new clinics and buy new MRI machines and all of that, but you can't just churn out new doctors and new nurses without fundamentally changing the system. And the old direction the system's moving in is cost containment. Pay them less money. Hold down their wage increases, cap doctors' fees. Well, that's going to have the exact opposite effect. And I think in Washington there's a political will to expand the pool of people who get service, and you saw that in the mental health parity, expand the service, but yet not, and they might or might not expand the money. That's going to be hard, probably, if they do it's deficit spending. But they sure as hell aren't going to expand the supply. And in fact, they'll probably constrict the supply. And when the supply is constricted and the demand explodes, you're talking about healthcare rationing. And when you look at the idea that, what is it, Chip, a quarter of the Medicare spending is in the last year of a patient's life, you're talking about a duty to die approach, like Dick Lamb once floated out in a moment of honesty for which he paid with his life. And he had a duty to die after he said that. But the point is that and if you think that people in America chafe at the idea of paying a lot of taxes, or chafe at the idea of dealing with an IRS and want government reform, wait till they start being told no. Not you need a second opinion, not let's go to another hospital, not, oh, I'll pay for this myself. No, just no, you may not have this bypass surgery because there's a 22-year-old illegal immigrant with a heart condition who has his life ahead of him, and you're a 78-year-old smoking diabetic with high blood pressure, and I don't care that you served in Iwo Jima. You're not getting it.
Well, from a Washington standpoint, a lot of health care reform is driven by people, either real strong leaders or constituents of people. 80% of people like their health care today. And that's not a real push for a political leader to go out and change it. So it's going to take leadership, but only 40% of people like the system. It comes back to the system itself, which gives us an opportunity there. Social good, consumer good, yourself or candidates?
Well, it's so hard to listen to Dick and not want to go point by point.
You got six in pretty quickly before, so go again.
What I really lament, truly, though, is this sort of immigrants against the world and rationing. This is the United States. We're not going to have England. We're not going to have another country. We're going to have an American healthcare system. It's not going to be a single payer. It's not going to be a government-run system. It's going to be a private-public system. We all know. It's not going to be only tax credits. It's not going to be just public programs. It can be all these things. And it's not going to be just about governments taking control or individuals being responsible. It has to be both. Individuals have to be responsible for their own care. We have to do a far better job. But the idea that we just throw people into this ocean of unregulated insurance systems or inadequate funding or a system that doesn't work because it's so costly and inaccessible is equally unacceptable. And so, the rhetoric of both sides, the far left and the far right, actually isn't where the debate is or should be. But part of that is your responsibility to make sure that's the case. We can't address access or costs without addressing coverage. We cannot do prevention well. We cannot do chronic care management well. We can't eliminate cost shifting. We can't have hospitals having all this bad debt because people who are uninsured come into the system and they can't afford it, or immigrants coming into the system and shifting costs back to the populations, or high deductible plans solely encouraging and insuring bad debt for hospitals because people can't afford the deductibles. But we similarly can't have a system where we have first dollar coverage for everything. We're just not going to have it. We can't afford it. We're going to have a system, if we're smart, that's clinically based, that if we're smart has cost sharing for things that we don't think work, and things that we want people to use, like prevention, has low or no cost sharing. We all know this. I mean, everyone in this room knows this. So I beg you all to avoid the rhetoric of the left and the right and focus on getting something done, because goodness knows we will not be able to not only have a sound healthcare system if we don't do it, we won't be able to have a sound economy.
We will hear tonight what we've heard through the primaries. The first words out of a Republican's mouth is going to be cost. Going back to the quick corollary, cost affects the uninsured and coverage. The first word out of the Democrats' mouth is going to be coverage. And you saw it throughout, and that's what the polling Kaiser, who does a wonderful job polling every 2 months on all this, has just shown it clearly and clearly. That's not where reality is, and we know it, but that's what we're going to probably hear again tonight. Although we just heard from Chip, first words out of his mouth, he didn't use the word universal, but was, in essence, 100% affordable coverage. But go back to the social versus consumer-oriented foundation.
I'm going to be parochial here and say we do have national health insurance in this country, and it's every American hospital. And whether it's the right kind of care at the right time, we can debate, but at least in terms of a baseline, at the end of the day, everybody looks the other way, but if people really need something, there's the hospital. And I think it's unsustainable. And that's where I think Chris's points are really well taken, that regardless of the moral question, regardless of the social question, at some point, it is unsustainable to depend on these 4,000 or 5,000 institutions to basically be the sort of receptacle of all the problems, as well as a great deal of the revenue of people that are covered. And so we need to get everybody covered. Otherwise, we're never going to be able to rationalize the system in a way. Now, at the same time, there's got to be a balance, because I think Chris makes a good point. Government and the taxpayer can't do everything. And we really do need individual responsibility. And that's not an easy balancing act, stakes. I mean, the whole crisis we're in now on the economic front shows a tremendous lack of individual responsibility, whether it was the bankers, whether it was the people on Wall Street, whether it was Sallie Mae, or whether it was the individuals who borrowed all that money when, if they had been rational and looking at it, they knew they couldn't pay it back. I mean, everybody looked the other way and look what happened. Well, in the healthcare system right now, everybody's looking the other way and leaving it to the hospitals. And I think that is untenable and unsustainable. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year, but at some point, it's got to be dealt with, just because we can't run the system the way we're running it now, I would argue, in perpetuity.
Let's turn to the plans. The problem with only having an hour and 15 minutes, I don't want to get into the details of the plans. We've already heard from Chris, I think is right, the details of the plans and from Dick are not going to be what happens. But I think it is important to at least run through it and comment on that in terms of a critique of the candidates' proposals. We'll get into a little bit tonight. Have they correctly defined sort of areas and means of reform? And how would each proposal affect the American people or the people in this room, the industry itself? Let's spend about 10 minutes on that. The plans themselves, so we don't have to get into details, hyperbole, again, going to the Kaiser website, because it's the one out there that I think is probably the easiest, most objective. You go to it, it's got everything in health care on it. Would basically say McCain, essentially 4 points, and Obama 4 points. I'm putting them out there now so we don't have to keep rehashing them, and a little bit exaggerated in the way they're written. But McCain, no mandates. Obama, employer mandate. And a children's mandate. McCain, eliminate tax deductibility of employer-sponsored insurance. Obama, regulate private insurance with guaranteed coverage and rate. McCain, provide tax credits to buy own insurance, the $2,500 and the $5,000 for a family. Obama, create a new public health care plan, something possibly like Medicare. And McCain, state grants for those rejected in the open market, kind of puts emphasis back on the states, doesn't describe it in very much detail. And then Obama, clear-cut expansion of Medicaid and SCHIP, looking at the uninsured. This is both exaggeration, but I want to put it out there. We don't have to go through all the points, but just to set the background and really to get it out of the way of what the candidates are likely to say. But let's talk a little bit about those plans' impact on people in the room here. Chip.
I see the dilemma with the Obama plan is that it doesn't reach universality. And none of the estimates say it does. And if you look at the Lewin estimate that will come out in the next few days, which I think is sort of the gold standard, you know, maybe it covers 27 or 30 million people. And it really is tremendously intrusive, both on employers. And if you remember back to the late 80s, early 90s, there was a controversy over non-discrimination rules that were put in regarding health care benefits. And once you get into trying to define employer role in healthcare and healthcare benefits, you get into an abyss. So he spends a lot of energy getting us into that, and then also getting all employers to be covered by some kind of government reinsurance, which will have all kinds of rules, and yet he doesn't even get to the goal of covering everybody. So that's why I look at his plan as sort of a bunch of ideas, but I'm not sure where he's going with it, because it's not as good as Hillary's plan. She got there, but then she didn't win. On the McCain side, you know, I guess my heart wants to be positive, but I think he plays with tax policy in a way that's just very uncertain. And yes, he's talking about cost, and Obama's talking about universality, but I'm not convinced either get there with what they have on the plate. And I wish in both cases that they had done more analysis. John Shields at Lewin and Associates, who's doing this major estimate, he said that when he wrote up the Obama plan, all he had to do was go back to the Kerry stuff, and basically that's what Obama's for, is what Kerry was for, and I don't think Kerry did a very good job. And on the other side, you know, I think that this tax area is worth looking at. And yes, we don't need an open-ended exclusion as we have now, but I think trying to shift everything away from employers is asking for trouble.
Yeah, if we have I don't know, 160 million people in employer-sponsored plans, what would the McCain plan do? And basically, we know what it'll do. It'll take away the deduction if you're an employer out there with margins
of
2%.
It's debatable, because he would argue, well, some employers will keep providing the coverage because they can get, because people can get cheaper coverage in their employment than they could outside. But then he's casting a lot of people into an individual market that would be relatively unregulated. So I think it's a great idea to provide everybody a fundable tax credit, but I just don't think it answers the questions at the end of the day.
All right, guys.
I think the fundamental tripwire here is the concept of mandates. You know, you kind of imagine you're in a prison yard. What are you in here for? I'm in here for armed robbery. Well, I'm doing 2 to 5 because I didn't offer health care to my employees, you know.
Can I?
Or I didn't cover my...
All right, go ahead. What about...
We're going to go.
I'll come back.
Point by point again.
I need to go. I'll come back. Go ahead. What are you going to say? I feel it bubbling.
Here's the reality that, you know, in America, when you say everyone should be individually responsible, they say... That makes sense. When they say that employers should provide a decent benefit to their workers, there should be shared responsibility between employers and employees, everyone sort of agrees. They even say an individual should be required to purchase and employers should be required to. But you use the word mandate or jail sentences or anything like that, people flip out, understandably so. But here's the reality. And everyone knows this in the healthcare policy world. You can't get everyone in the system without some sort of requirement. And everyone knows this. So we can talk about now. I did with others Senator Hillary Clinton's plan. So I, you know, thank you for the compliment. but you know, let's step back a little bit. Senator McCain's policy. You talk about radical. We're talking about eliminating the tax exclusion for health care. You ask what employers will do. If you're on the edge of providing or not providing, you're not going to provide. And people are going to go into a tax. They're going to get this, oh, I get my tax credit, which is not adequate to purchase a health care benefit, in an unregulated health care delivery system. At the state level, you can go in every state you want to go to. Any state you want to go to, whatever benefit. Now, let me tell you, insurers will insure the healthy people. But if you have a pre-existing condition, you wouldn't get health care. You couldn't afford health care. John McCain couldn't afford his own health care system because his insurer wouldn't...
He has a risk pool, though. You've got to be fair.
You mean because he's old enough to have Medicare?
He has a risk pool in his plan.
he has an unfunded risk pool in his plan. And here's the last thing. Yesterday we learned in the Wall Street Journal, I was going to do tax exclusion for all things, just for income tax, not for payroll. So I'm going to have $1.3 trillion that I'm going to have to cut from Medicare and Medicaid to pay for my plan. Well, hospitals of the world unite, because that you're going to see pain in Medicare and Medicaid cuts.
Well, he was unspecific in the Medicaid.
Let's keep moving. Let me go, Dick. I cut you off. John, jump in. I'll come back.
I think that just to pick up on Chris's last point. I think there are two things wrong, really, with McCain's healthcare approach. I agree with Chris that it's extremely radical. One is that by going to a model in which you can sell insurance across state lines without any benefit floor, you're essentially wiping out state regulation of insurance plans. And what you're going to see happen, I think, in the health insurance world is what happened in the credit card world, which is that the basic rights are going to go to the state with the least regulation. That's going to be sold across the country. And the net result of that is what Chris observed, which is people with pre-existing conditions are going to be out of luck because they're basically in plans today because there is a floor. I think if you look at the bipartisan plans that are now gaining momentum in Congress, I see Jim Cooper here, who's really worked very hard to to get momentum going again in the Congress. One of their features is that they at least provide a basic floor of what benefits would occur even if as you move to a different system of health insurance. And McCain really scraps that in favor of this so-called consumer-driven model. The other thing is that, and it's the reason that Chris mentioned this piece in the Wall Street Journal, the reason I think that this has really become a problem for McCain is that what he's ended up doing is providing a $5,000 refundable tax credit, refundable in his favor, but it is adjusted by the rate of consumer price index, consumer inflation, as opposed to health the cost of health care going up, which is higher. And ultimately, this is going to cause people in the middle of the income system to actually incur a tax increase. And I think one of the reasons that they backed off taking the exclusion away from the payroll tax is that tax increase could be as much as $1,000 by 2013 on people in the middle of the income spectrum. So I think he was worried about getting accused, as I think the Obama campaign has rightly accused him, of saying that he's going to actually raise taxes on people in the middle of the income spectrum. And therefore, he said, well, I will solve that problem by not applying the exclusion on payroll tax, but that leaves him the $1.3 trillion hole. How does he fill it? Cut Medicare. So, I mean, I think his plan doesn't add up. I think it would end up with leaving the sickest and most vulnerable people with pre-existing conditions out in the cold. And ultimately, I think it'll be interesting to see whether they get into the details tonight, because I think he'll have a very hard his economic advisors and healthcare advisors have a hard time explaining it. I suspect that Senator McCain will have a really hard time explaining what he's actually put forward.
Dick.
I think that we're underestimating the impact of mandates as a political issue. Just as you have a tripwire in terms of tax increases, you also have one in terms of mandates. And I think that that may be a factor of the election, depending on how skillful McCain is at raising it in tonight's debate. But if it isn't, and if Obama wins, and if he proceeds to implement his plan, the abrasions caused by those mandates are going to be the key issue in the elections of 2010 and 2012. You got one of those situations like with Rostenkowski, where he passes a tax increase and then he goes home and gets hounded by his constituency and has to go back and repeal it. The American people are not going to take kindly to that mandate, and they're going to resent it, and it's going to become a huge thing. I just want to focus on the other half of the issue, though. All of this discussion is on funding incremental care and providing incremental funding. And I know that it's fashionable now in healthcare circles to talk about cost reduction only in terms of things like leading a better life and not smoking and watching your weight and exercising and dealing with prevention of chronic conditions. But I think a huge portion of what the practical thing that you all are going to have to do when you're confronted with a government that is going to dump a whole lot of new patients on you without a whole lot of new money to pay for them and without a whole lot of new supply to pay for them, is that you're going to have to really be good at, even better than you are now, at cost containment and at cost reduction based on operating efficiencies within your hospital itself. And here I'm a little bit singing for my supper because I'm here sponsored by IMF, the IMS. I mix it up with INS. And what they do in terms of increasing utilization of the OR by 15-20% by scrubbing it and working on the system. Those kinds of changes, where you actually lubricate the system and make it flow better, where you really go back to a kind of management and budget approach to healthcare facilities, is just going to become absolutely crucial, because you're about to have the politicians in Washington dump a whole lot of more responsibility on you without the funding for it. And if you think you're having trouble now with people that walk in, wait until you see the stuff that they're entitling people to get. And the need for a fundamental restructuring of your services to increase their efficiency and deliver the same thing for less, I think is going to be the dominant focus over the next 4 years.
Yep.
I think we do. This mandate issue that Dick brings up is really a critical one. I think ultimately there does have to be some kind of requirements if we're going to have universal coverage. But I think we do mandates on employers at our peril. I already referred to Section 89. We can talk about other kinds of policies that have failed, where there was an attempt to...
You know, employers is bad. Parents is worse.
Well, that's true. But the problem we're going to have next year with no money, at least in the federal coffers, is that policymakers are going to say, well, gee, can't we get so-and-so to do it without having it on our ledger? And I think the proposal in this campaign of employer mandates sort of slides into next year if there's a big Democratic victory and an Obama victory, because it's going to be easy to say, we're going to put this on somebody else's ledger, but a mandate is a tax. I think in the case of individuals, as in the Clinton plan, maybe it is a tax there too, but then you're going to be subsidizing individuals and getting those who can't afford it, who don't have disposable income, covered. I think with employers, though, in this economy, we want a voluntary system. We don't want to force them into something, because I think that will either blow up the political process, or it'll lead to an outcome we don't like, and it'll have to be overturned. You know, it really is interesting. Medicare catastrophic that passed in 88 was repealed in 89 because the old geezers got on Rostenkowski's car and made a lot of trouble. And people thought that was really a great thing at the time it passed. But once the American people looked at it, they said, we don't really like this. And we can't afford to go through health care reform that Americans aren't going to like after it passes.
And what was interesting about the 88 Rostenkowski event, everybody has that picture outside Chicago. He came out of a town meeting, and the picture of the older, more polite,
let us
senior
forget,
person.
Let us not forget he went to jail a few years later.
No, that's right. But also what happened a few years later in 1991, the Wofford race,
right.
And then we came in with Clinton. So, again, over a four-year horizon, we got to remember that certain things happen at certain points in time and can precipitate other things. Because
yeah.
That was in 88, 91, 92, 93. Chris.
Senator, I just want a couple more cleanup points. First is that, you know, if I'm a hospital today and I'm worried about suddenly people coming in that are actually paying, that's a good thing. I already have a lot of people coming in who aren't paying. And that's a huge problem. Everyone in this room who has a hospital, who has uncompensated care burdens, well recognizes that. Secondly, on the requirement or the mandate or individual requirement, let's face facts here. As Ronald Reagan said, 90% of the voting public has health insurance today. Okay, 90%. They'll be for covering everyone because they're worried about losing it, and they're also paying for those people who don't have it. The cost shifting is coming back to them in terms of higher premiums. And P.S., they can't regulate the insurance industry the way they need to have it, which is to say, to require insurers to guarantee coverage without an individual requirement. That's just the reality. And all of us can dance around this, but that is the policy reality. Now, as for the business requirement or business responsibility or contributions or mandates, let's be clear about Obama. He recognizes that the growth in our economy has been and will be small business. So he does not require small businesses to pay into this. In fact, not only does he not require that, he has a tax credit to encourage them to provide it. Most larger employers are, not just because they feel they have to, but because they want to be able to recruit and retain a very, very good workforce. So again, let's put this all in context. I think people have learned from the problems of the Health Security Act, which did include an employer requirement even for small business at some point. And I think you have to take that off the table, as Senator Obama does.
I find myself oddly in agreement with Dick on one point.
We used to work the same guy.
We did. I think the idea that the curve has to bend is really a starting point in this healthcare debate with respect to costs. We're spending 16%, maybe pushing up closer to 17% of GDP on healthcare in the United States. The next highest OECD countries at about 11%, and then falls off beyond there. I think the question, I think you kind of slid over wellness, disease management, disease prevention. I think there are substantial savings that can happen there, but the incentives in the current system are wrong. Chip talked about that earlier in the conversation when he suggested that people coming in and out of the system is a prescription for bad management. And the basic, an insurance system designed for an acute care system doesn't really deliver the goods with respect to disease management and wellness and the production of wellness and the cost savings that could come from that. And so I think there'll be a lot of emphasis on that. I think there is to some extent. I think to go back to Senator Clinton, her emphasis on, she just introduced legislation on this, in fact, was maybe a little bit stronger in her plan than in the Obama plan, but I think you'll see a lot of attention paid to that. But the other part is, how do you get trusted information to try to decide and how do you reward and create the payment structures that are necessary to reward cost-effective delivery of medical services? And I think if you look, again, you look forward to what's likely to happen in the next Congress, and I think there are particularly ideas. These are bipartisan ideas in the Congress. I think there's a gulf between where McCain and Obama are, but not so much, I think, in the Congress. There's strong bipartisan support to try to look at how you create a trusted system of information, whether that's on a public-private basis or my colleague Tom Daschle, who is a former leader with Senator Frist, has proposed a health fed that would be an independent agency that could look at the delivery of service, try to find cost-effective savings in the system, and then begin to reward people for performance in the healthcare system. I think those are ideas that are likely to really move forward in the next Congress so that we can bend that curve and do what Dick probably rightly suggests, which is to try to do more with at least the same level of overall resources that are currently being put in the system.
Let's remember that we spend $2.1 trillion a year on health care in this country and about $550 billion on education. I mean, that's a mistake. We shouldn't do that.
Well, just to relate that, picking up this whole behavior, how you incentivize it, government's not going to do that. Not going to be able to. We're all, me no longer, but you guys are still Washington. But the people in the room here are in the business. And what I'm hearing a little bit is that the squeeze, we'll come back to that, that we're going to see at the federal level, it will be an attempt to shift it as far down as you can, or as far out of Washington as you can. It'll go to the states. States are in just as bad trouble, so it'll be pushed down. The squeeze is there, so it comes down to bending the cost curve, shifting it, administrative costs, get the things out, then also bending it. Who is going to be the best at bending the cost curve? I think it really will be people who are in the business,
yeah,
the private
yeah.
sector, how government incents that.
Right.
But a smaller bucket of money to spend, a real push among Republicans and Democrats to get more people in the system out of equity issues, moral issues, the right thing to do, you get better care. So it's going to be more value in the system. And the frictionless system, the system that increases value, we don't know how to do it very well, but the people in this room ultimately.
But we need to do that. We need health IT. We need better information, and we need to change payment structures to incentivize value-driven care.
Yeah.
I want to just return to what I said at the very beginning of this. I am very pessimistic about, which is unusual for me, about the economic situation we face. I think that the subprime was just the beginning of a four-year process of basically detoxing us ourselves from debt and from this overextension of credit. The next domino to fall will probably be the credit card debt, the consumer debt, which now has doubled as a percentage of GDP over the last 20 years. And then after that, you're probably talking about auto loan debt. And there are going to be a series of bailouts because the Fed and Treasury have made very clear that they are not going to let the Great Depression happen again. They are going to drown with money anybody that is, any major industry that is failing. And they'll do that. I think that's a wise thing to do. But it is going to make impossible any significant increase in spending on anything else over the next 3 or 4 years. Just be realistic. Healthcare reform walked out, the money for healthcare reform walked out the door last week. And those
Does
guys.
Does everybody agree with that?
Those guys today no. aren't going to say it.
No.
But it's gone.
All right, go ahead. Do you agree right now, $1 trillion, 700 plus the other bailouts, $1 trillion over the last 3 weeks. Medicare, Medicaid is going to be 4.1 just in the foreseeable future. That's just what we're already obligated. We are going to see S-CHIP expansion no matter who's there here in the next couple of years, I predict, with the Democratic – we're talking about president mainly, but remember, again, the Democratic majorities in the Senate and in the House are going to greatly increase. So we're going to see some expansion there. I don't know if it's going to be $10 billion a year, but we're going to see that for sure. Then do you agree that we don't have any more money to spend on reform?
No, and I'll tell you the reason why is, and this goes to Dick's point about we are spending $2.1 trillion, but if we change nothing, in 10 years we'll be spending $4.1 trillion. We're going to be doubling. So, and again, people in Washington and people outside of Washington get this. They view that as unsustainable. There will be huge pressures to cut and bend that curve line, even in current programs. My point is that the only way that you really are going to bend that so-called curve is do what John just suggested, which is we are going to have to invest in IT. We are going to have to do some more quality work. We're going to have to do reimbursement incentives, yes, through Medicare and other entities, in order to change how we deliver health care in this country. And the outcome of that will be that health care will become more affordable and we will be able to do more things in terms of coverage of expansion. And again, the reason why I think the coverage issue is so important is it maximizes our ability to be efficient in the delivery of health care. It's not an altruistic act. It's an economic one.
Yeah, I'd say one of the big problems, though, is having worked on the Hill, you've really got to approach this humbly, which they won't. And I was involved in VBA 97 and other acts that the development of the physician fee schedule early in late in the 80s, early in the 90s, and we thought we knew everything, and we developed a lot of good policies, and I heard a lot about payment policy. And RBRVS was supposed to solve the problem for primary care. Well, I think if you talk to any internist or family practitioner, all they know is that their Medicare rates were threatened to be cut every year for the last 4 or 5 years. So I think our problem is that I'm not sure we know how to do everything we need to do, and government tends to act as in a meat cleaver fashion, as it's doing a favor. So I guess I'm with you. We need to do something, but I'm really nervous about it.
Let me ask you, what would you IT? Clearly, transparency, accountability, the world that everybody in here works in, markets. You got to have transparency. You got to know what you're buying. You got to know the quality. We know that's a problem with healthcare, third party payers, and the like. IT helps transparency, know what you're buying for the first time in 40 years. What is the government responsibility in IT? Barack says put $10 billion in. I don't know what the details beyond that. McCain says I'm all for it. Hillary Clinton and I had a bill that we worked on and back with Chris and Dean and I. And we got to do something. What should the federal government do for IT? They set the railroad tracks back 130 years ago, and they defined these standards. But when I last talked to one of these healthcare groups, there were 6,000 vendors out there, and not much is happening. We've talked it. What should the federal government do?
You know, I think we need to be careful with IT, because, you know, to sort of quote Clinton, it's the workflow, stupid. It's not the IT. IT has all kinds of implications for how healthcare is delivered. And actually, if you look around the world, you know, we say, oh, the world is so much better off than we are. Well, first, no country has real interoperability of IT. And second, you know, we can go to Israel, we can go to the Scandinavian countries. You know, some of them have pretty good systems inside the hospital, although actually, if you look at the data, we actually have more IT in hospitals than many of the foreign countries that are further developed than us. And second, outside, you know, these are basically replacing paper records with IT. So I think we've got to do a lot of thinking about if you're going to spend $10 billion, what you're going to spend it on. Because the savings from IT aren't from the IT. They're from the increased efficiency that ought to come from it, the better knowledge about patients, the different ways doctors and patients interact, the e-prescribing, that avoids mistakes, and it's a lot more complicated than we've been talking about. And it's not something that can just be done with a wand. So I'm all for the IT, but it's something we've got to approach very carefully.
I turn to Dick, and then to comment on IT, then we'll move on. But it is so obvious in terms of markets.
Actually, I'm going to not deal with IT as much as
another
area.
Then hold on one second.
Area.
Let's stay on IT once our problems come to you. Anything on IT between
well,
the two of you?
I mean, I believe it is a tool, not an outcome. I agree totally. But is it a necessary precondition in order to be able to maximize efficiency in this system? And also, I would argue, to do the quality-value discussion that we all say is an imperative part of the discussion, rather than going back to the normal traditional way we did back in, you know, whenever the hell we did, 97, which was just market basket minus. You know, we do very that. What we really want to do is what you've been advocating, Senator, for such a long time, and Senator Mitchell and others. We've got to change how we deliver health care. But we can't do it well without that IT infrastructure, which includes an investment and which includes interoperability standards, which includes the involvement of investment of all the provider community. And that's, you know, I say it's a necessary precondition for what the goals that we seek.
Not a cure-all, though, if
no.
I could say. Okay. Anything else on IT, then we'll move on today.
Well, I think there's some legal impediments to the to the proper introduction of IT, both on the antitrust side, on the Stark rule side, that need to be cleaned up. And I think that's getting into the weeds, but I think that's an important thing that Congress could pay some attention to so that we incentivize the real parties in interest to actually put the IT through the system and get the results that I think Chris was talking about. But, you know, at a high level, when you think about it, for an industry that is at the cutting edge of technology globally, the use of information technology to create efficiencies in the system is moved down to almost a unit-by-unit level. You know, if Walmart did business that way, they'd be out of business. And so I think the model is conceptual, and then we got to get the incentives right to get to power that through the system, I think.
All right. Good. All right, Dick.
First, I just want to reinforce something that John said. The idea of interstate insurance and then that stripping state regulators of their ability to regulate is really something we need to focus on. The coming crisis of credit cards is entirely due to that. In 1978, the Supreme Court ruled that when you have an interstate transaction between a borrower and a lender, the law that applies is the law governing the lender, which meant that all the credit card companies moved to South Dakota, which had no law at all, and the result is that all usury limits in the other 49 states became worthless because they couldn't regulate it, and it led to a totally unregulated industry. Feds don't regulate it because it's a state mandate, and the states can't do it because the court won't let them. And if you get into that with health insurance, it's going to be a horrific disaster, including on parity, mental health, and all of the other issues. The second thing I want to say is that I believe we have to pay a great deal of attention to drug companies and to that aspect of health care costs. It's 10% of the total health care bill. 12% of the total amount of money spent on drugs pays for 50% of the drugs. It's 88, the generics. It's 88% that pays for the other 50%. You need to require all state Medicaid plans to give preference to prescription drug benefits. When the states have tried to do that on their own, like California, they've been defeated by pharma in the lobbying battle. It's crucial that take place. You need to change. You need to have much tougher antitrust enforcement of the generic alternatives so that big drug companies can't game the system to buy up their rights to generics so that other companies don't do it. You have to pass that legislation requiring disclosure of any doctor benefits paid to doctors by insurance companies. You need to have sharp limitations and disclosure on doctors receiving benefits and goodies and Super Bowl tickets and bribes from drug company representatives. You need to eliminate or ban prescription drug advertising, a $4 to $7 billion a year cost that is totally unnecessary in this system. If you really take an aggressive approach to cost control of the roughly $200 billion we're spending on prescription medication, there's a lot you could take out of that system. And this is the point I was making with my buddies at IMS. You've got to look at the internal workings of this system. I remember so vividly, John and Chris, when I met with Hillary in 93 and 94, when she was putting together her health care plan, my friend Harvey Siegelbaum is in the audience. He and I went down to see Hillary, and that was when I was pretty close with her, and we were talking about health care, and I walked in, and initially, the health care reform task force that she headed was originally going to be a new Hoover commission to try to scrub the system to reduce costs. It was introduced because Bill Clinton warned that we currently spend 12% of GDP on health care, and he warned that unless we acted, we would end up spending 14%. We're now at 16 going to 17. And instead of a Hoover commission that kind of became Gore's thing with reinventing government, Hillary got health care, but Bill always saw it as a subset of cost containment. So I remember going into meeting with her in the White House and with this whole long list of cost containments, require second opinions, you know, all of that stuff. Some of the stuff I just talked about drugs. And it wasn't anywhere on her radar screen. What she was focusing on was universal care and expanding the system and the whole bit. We need to return to the concept of better management of healthcare facilities with federal mandates to require that that happen. Because this fundamental lack of management is something that that really has to be addressed. In terms of management, but also in terms of the drug industry and other elements of the system. Another big part of it is nursing homes. With the health care reform limiting med malpractice, you essentially take away from anyone in a nursing home the right to sue because they don't have any future earnings or anything, and they can't sue for pain and suffering. That means you have an entire industry there that can promote barbaric conditions in nursing homes without any effective federal, state, or litigatory legislation. These are the kinds of innards of the system that I think we need to start dealing with more seriously.
Let me have all of us look in the crystal ball and be ready to eat question last, which we all will have to do. We got 2 years from now. We've got... vehicles 16 months from now, any physicians in the office are going to see Medicare cut their reimbursement 20%. I've been hearing it since 2002, but it never happened. But it's still, even flat reimbursement over a period of 5 years, a huge cut for a physician. So that's a vehicle that's coming through, riding through the system. No matter, everybody here said, no, we're not going to see much reform, a little bit more optimism here, but that's a vehicle. And depending on the reaction to the economic straits that we're in, people may jump on board. It may get comprehensive, but it's a vehicle coming through, whether we like it or not. I like it because 20% cut is crazy. What do you see happening in the next 2 years, the next 4 years, and then a comment on anything about gridlock, which obviously locks things down. Gridlock's not all bad. If we do have a Democratic president, Senate, and the House, it won't be as much gridlock for better or for worse. But give me a two-year thing. I'm going to try to keep it in 4 years. And then a comment on gridlock. Is there anything practically we can get over to it?
Maybe I could just set a political scene for it, and then others can talk about the medical implications of it. Obama's probably going to win. He'll take with him a humongous Democratic majority in both houses. He won't be.
How many seats in the House?
About 30 extra seats in the House, and about about 7 to 10 extra seats in the Senate.
Okay.
Maybe as many as 13 in the Senate, but I think 57, something like that.
All right.
You just solved the gridlock problem.
Yeah.
Well, that's right.
There's no gridlock.
Frictionless system coming through.
This is the British Parliament
keep
now
going.
We're talking about.
Keep going.
Yeah, but it's going to be the gridlock of the grave. There won't be the gridlock over what do we do. The gridlock will be that we can't do anything. And it'll be a gridlock, not against the opposite party, but against reality.
Explain that, just so people understand.
Well, you're going to have so many demands on the federal treasury, and such a limited ability to run a deficit because of the underlying crisis of confidence in the economy and in our currency, that the political establishment is going to be rendered essentially helpless in dealing with it. So there won't be the opposite party to deal with. That'll be the happy days. This will be dire necessity to deal with. And they're going to be essentially powerless. And what's going to happen is things are going to get worse and worse. Obama is going to be hated in the United States. His ratings will go, as Elton John once said, too low for zero. People will look back to the halcyon days when we had Bush as president. And a really popular president. And Obama will get away for the first 6 or 8 months on blaming Bush, but then that'll wear increasingly thin.
Now, Congress is already down to 15% favorability. Yeah. You can't go any lower than that.
And there'll be a humongous Republican tide in 2010, which will now restore partisan gridlock. And so I think that you have 2 years of two unique years, just like 64, 65, 1913, 1914, 35, 36, and 81, 82. Those were the four periods where probably 70% of the important legislation passed under Wilson, Roosevelt, Reagan, and Johnson. You'll have another period like this under Obama, but he won't be able to use it. And it'll be gone after 2 years because there'll be a massive revolt against a terrible economy, against an inability to deliver on any of the campaign promises and all of that. And then you'll have a Republican Congress and a lame duck Democratic president, and this is where I came in.
All right. All right. All right. 2 years. Chris is sitting there all the time looking at legislation there. And so now we got this big picture. I know you've got 10 things to say.
No. Let's give it to John first.
All right. John, everybody came here to take away something to talk about.
If Dick's prescription was applied against history, then Hoover would be a great icon in American politics, and Roosevelt would have failed. That's true. I think that he talked about the mid '60s and after President Kennedy was killed. And that's of course when Medicare and Medicaid were passed. But I think that in the next couple of years, the president has to focus on getting the economy moving, getting wages growing again, which I think has been particularly a problem over the last 8 years, not just over the last year. We've now had 750,000 people lost their job this year, but wages haven't grown for average wage earners through the course of the Bush presidency. That's what he's got to focus on. I see healthcare as a part of that, and I think that if Obama is elected, he will make healthcare a front and center issue. Appropriately, Senator, put it in a 2-year, 4-year time frame. My guess is that what he will want to do is to try to get a major reform going, the kinds of ideas he's talked about, in one bite, and do it early and try to get it done in 2009. I think there's an alternative strategy, which is to put those building blocks in place, either a health bed or a cost-effectiveness private-public-private partnership to try to get the cost going down, to try to do an S-chip expansion. The states are going to need help on Medicaid, and to try to set the stage for trying to do a more major expansion of reform after a successful midterm election by historical standards.
I said it'd be successful.
In 2010. And I'm fairly certain what his preference will be, I'm not certain what the landscape will be. It'll depend to some extent on what the congressional numbers look like. We obviously have to deal with some other big concerns, not just the financial crisis, but the energy crisis, dealing with, transforming and investing in new businesses and new technology. But I see healthcare as a place where if you apply the right principles, you can actually get a boost in the economy, and I think that's what his front and center concern is going to be.
Chris, we'll see. Biogenerics, mental health parity, some S-chip expansion. The next 2 years, will we see anything else? Think of the congressional standpoint now and sort of past discussions.
Right. Well, I think those are two areas. And Dick was talking about a lot of the generic access issues, and there will be an interest in doing that. And interestingly, both McCain and
and Senator Obama are big, big advocates of going in that direction. I think you mentioned also the physician payment issue, which is a train that will be coming out there no matter what. And in a way, the physicians, you can't even deal with it. The cut this year is so big
20%.
That you cannot do it without, I would suggest, probably some baseline issue changes, but in particular, some reform issue about how healthcare is delivered, and with a bigger focus on primary care. And I think we would be silly not to move in that direction, and I see that happening. I actually think that we will have a debate regardless on healthcare. I mean, the question is whether or not it will be focused on a more traditional budget cut world or whether it will be delivery reform world and setting up the predicate for, you know, a much more efficient system. I'm optimistic that we will have a delivery reform world, and I think there'll be a lot of people, a lot of stakeholders at the table who want to play. And once the president, and I think it will be President Obama, comes in, he will, if he signals that that is a priority, there'll be lots of people wanting to play.
Chip, go on.
I think early on, just like family leave, that child health will be, family leave was visited immediately in 1993. I think child health will be visited, and there'll be a big bill like the House passed that maybe includes a lot of Medicare things as well as quality things, everything that's sort of sitting around other than child health that doesn't cost extra money, unless they can put the docs in there with some kind of 1-2 that makes it not cost anything, which is possible, I think, if Congress just decided to look the other way. I think beyond that, I'm just totally, my crystal ball is totally cloudy, because, you know, I never would have predicted 9/11. I never would have predicted what happened a few weeks ago to the economy. And I just think that I never would have predicted that Obama would be running against McCain. I mean, we had at the Federation meeting last October, Larry Sabato, and he said, the one thing you can be sure about in this campaign season is that John McCain is finished. And he got the darn nomination. So, boy, I can't see the future as clearly as Dick.
Todd, I said Hillary was going to win.
And I'm not sure I want to. I was going to say that, but. But I can tell you, I think whether it's in March, April, or May, there's going to be a big health bill, and it's going to include a lot of stuff, and it's not going to be a big reform bill, but it's going to answer a lot of questions for people in this room, I think, in terms of specific issues they've been worried about.
Tom Sigrin says, run it like heart surgery. Start on time and finish on time. And,
when you became majority leader, I said the only thing being majority leader and heart surgery have in common is you have to break a lot of ribs.
Yeah. No, you go in and you cut out parts and you put new ones in. But, you know, it is fascinating listening, and I can't help. I've really just sort of come back home over the last year. But when you think about it, what everybody's just heard here, the huge opportunity. Everything is value. The macro constraints out there mean that whether it's behavioral health or psychiatric or mental health across our cube, it really is up to people in this room. And having been in Washington, I recognize how important it is for everybody in here to be thinking where you are on this ethical spectrum, pick one of the candidates. But the big thing is to work with whoever is in there addressing these issues that tie into education, to the outcome in terms of our economy long-term, to our global competitiveness, and we're in a unique position. I think even a lot of people in the room don't realize how unique this room is. This group does, because we talked about it earlier this morning. I want to thank John, Chris, Chip, and Dick for joining us today, coming from Washington, D.C. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I know our audience members are truly grateful for your time. Join me, and we have some final remarks from Caroline, but join me in thanking this panel.
Thank you, Chip. Thank you. All right, John. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Frist, and thank you to the esteemed panel. We appreciate you being with us at such a very busy time. I would like to once again recognize our sponsors. They are Aon, Bolt, Cummings, Connors, and Barry, the Federation of American Hospitals, and IMS. I'd also like to say a word of thanks to Gresham Smith and Partners for their help in staging this event today. And lastly, thanks to all of you. We hope you have a wonderful morning and stay tuned tonight.
Thank you all.